I want to welcome Agile XRM to the podcast. I've known the people at Agile XRM for the past 12 years. I've seen how their business process management tool can add massive value to complex organizational processes in sectors such as finance and government. If you have complex processes or a need for dialogues on the Power Platform or Dynamics 365, take a look at how this BPM tool can add value. You can find them at agilexrm.com or check out the show notes for more details. Hi everyone, and welcome again to another Power Platform show. Today we have Rami on the show. He's a solution architect. He's been many years in the Dynamics 365 and now Power Platform space, a well-known architect in New Zealand, and worked for many partners and been across many projects over his career. He's an established author. He wrote a book called the Microsoft Dynamics 365 Extensions Cookbook, and he's really a leader in the Dynamics community in Wellington, New Zealand. We're going to drill in and look at architecture, fast track architecture, and really the role of the architect and even an enterprise architect in a Microsoft business application. So I hope you enjoy this episode. Full show notes can be found at nz365guy.com/234. Hey Rami, welcome to the Power Platform show.
Hey Mark, how's it going?
Good. Good to have you on the show. I've known you for many, many years, and of course you're an MVP, but I've not got you on the MVP show. I've got you on the Power Platform show because today I want to talk all about architecture from your point of view, someone that's been in architecture for many, many years in the BizApp space.
Yeah, that's correct. We have known each other for a long time, even before the MVP time.
Yeah,
I do remember the early stages when we were up in Auckland presenting together at Ignite and TechEd. That was, you know, a long, long time ago.
Many years ago. Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly. So tell us a bit about, you know, before we get underway, so our guests know, where do you live, work, and play in New Zealand?
So I'm in Wellington at the moment. I've been in Wellington for quite a long time, probably about 10 years plus, reaching 15 actually. And yeah, I sort of moved to Wellington with my back then girlfriend, you know, being unmarried, and yeah, I found a job and, you know, built my career in Wellington. And Wellington being the political capital of New Zealand, I'm surrounded by the public sector. So a lot of the work that I did in this space was around the public sector. And then, you know, you start there and then you start getting some connections and you start knowing the vendors and all of that. And next thing you know, 10 years have passed and you're still having fun.
Yeah. How did you get into Microsoft BizApps? How did your career take that turn and you get into this area of technology?
Yeah, so when I first started, obviously coming sort of from the university, I was technology agnostic, and I was really big on being technology agnostic. Like, you know, I prefer to use a Linux operating system rather than Windows just because, you know, I was young and I wanted to make it be different. But then, you know, when I joined the professional world, I had the choice to either join a Java company or a Microsoft company. And by pure luck, it was a Microsoft company that I joined. And I do remember I was sort of sitting behind my desk, just a young grad, listening around. And one of the business development managers came to my boss and he said, "Oh, that customer, I have three letters for them, CRM. And I was like, "What is CRM? And then my boss looked at me, he's like, "Do you want to learn CRM?" And I'm like, "Yeah, sure." I had a .NET background and I thought maybe was the right career progression. There was like SharePoint options and there were dynamic CRM options. So I thought, let's give CRM a go. And that's how it started. And I started building the CRM systems back in CRM 3.0, mainly 4.0, and then, you know, learned the product, loved it. And, you know, very well back then, we were experts in the product, right? It was such a small product that we knew everything in it and we knew all the workarounds. We had hacks and, you know, that was like the good, the bad and the ugly of CRM 4.0. And obviously the platform has evolved so much and the Power Platform was introduced. And now you've got, you know, CDS or Dataflex and, you know, separation of layers, first party apps, and, you know, lots of new things happen where you know, the sky is the limit, basically. So yeah, it's been an amazing journey. And, you know, I once met with James Phillips and I told him, you know, I just want to thank you because I built my career around the awesome work that you guys do. And he really appreciated that, you know, the products that they're doing are not only making a difference to the customers, but also to the vendors and to the professionals as well.
Yeah, so true, so true. And hasn't that landscape changed from really, you know, a couple of ERP applications and, of course, CRM, which we had three modules back then, customer service, marketing, and sales. And now we've got, you know, I think it's over 30 different application and technologies that exactly break up the BizApp suite. And one of the journeys that you would have gone on is the transition between an on-prem based projects, being that you work for a partner, to online. And what's that experience been like for you being in New Zealand? Our closest data center here is Sydney, Australia. And of course, when we started, you know, back in the day, that transition, Singapore used to be our local data center. And of course, we were always, the biggest issue was a latency issue that we used to run into, right? And speed of deployments in that data center. And particularly, I remember back then, your ISP could change the route, you know, they'd go for the least cheapest route from a customer's perspective to a location, which often was the slowest. And of course, increase latency until Microsoft started putting all their backbone fiber and whatnot, dark fiber in place. What's that journey for you? Are you touching any on-premise projects these days, or is it now 100% all cloud-based?
Yeah, that's actually an interesting one. And there is a bit of history, especially in the sort of Wellington market or in the public sector behind it. So I remember it was either my first MVP summit or my second one when I was in Redmond and I was, you know, meeting a lot of the MVP people. Especially I was having a chat with some of the Scandinavian ones. I think it was Juka or it was, I can't remember exactly Auntie. Who it was. But anyway, as we were having a discussion, I asked them, what is your percentage of users or customers preferring to use an online version versus an on-premise? And they had something like 85% or 90% of their customers are using the online services. And I was surprised because we were behind in New Zealand where it was not really the opposite. Like we had a little bit of uptake from a, you know, online perspective for customers, but there's quite a few that were still on-premise. And part of it was because there was no data center in Australia at the time, but also because as they introduced Australian data centers, there was a little bit of hesitance to actually use a near-shore data center to host your data, especially in the public sector where they want everything to be either onshore or they want to touch the data. They want to have access to it, which is a bit of an old mentality. And I do remember sort of working closely with Microsoft and coming up with the GCIO 105 questions and answers just to give them assurance that the environment that they're going to sort of install their products on is going to be secure and that they're going to get all the assurance that they are after. And we sort of gradually sort of said that nearshore is okay. And that came out from the government saying that, yes, that's okay. We can use nearshore. The Australian data centers have been approved. And at that stage, I was at ACC. And at ACC specifically, there was the question is, are we going on-premise or are we going online? And we said, let's do it online. We've got the approval. Let's go ahead. And we did that. And the moment that the project went live, all the other government departments follow suit. So I sort of like, you know, feel proud that it was, you know, one of the first projects, if not the first project in the public sector that went on Dynamics Online. And everybody else thought if it works for them and, you know, they bit the bullet and they did it, then it's going to work for us. And then the rest followed. The next organization was MB, which was also one of our customers. And then the rest was history. So it's really good to see that transition. Nowadays, if I'm touching on-premise implementations, it's most likely because they're doing an upgrade to online. So it's a legacy one that has reached its end of life, or they don't want to sort of support the infrastructure or whatever it is. And then they decided, all right, now it's time to actually migrate all of that into the online services.
Yeah, very good, very good. So just what Rami said there about ACC, for those international, that stands for Accident Compensation Corporation. And in New Zealand, if you have a workplace accident, the government's insurance, it's basically a government insurer that covers you. So it's not the employer that insures you as such. So that's the organization Rami was talking about there. So that's interesting. And so with the migration to on-prem, then, and when you're touching these on-prem projects, Are you mainly using FastTrack, the FastTrack program, to do that?
Yes, if they qualify, we'll definitely go with FastTrack. But a lot of it depends on what sort of implementation they're doing. Some of those implementations are legacy or, you know, have seen quite a few years. And since then, from a customer perspective, the business requirements have changed. And as such, the solution itself is not fit for purpose. If we're going to an OP to OL, so on-premise to online migration through the FastTrack program, then this is a like-for-like upgrade, and basically it's going to take the schema, it's going to take the configuration, the customization, it's going to take your data, and it's going to upgrade it through different sort of versions of Dynamics. And it's amazing. The tool that they've got is absolutely amazing. So, you know, a message there is that if people are eligible for a FastTrack program, or even there's a new initiative by Microsoft to actually do those migrations from on-premise to online, not necessarily through FastTrack, but Microsoft is providing that as a service, that if, you know, they do want an upgrade from an older version and a like-for-like upgrade to the latest version online, then, you know, to leverage those tools is absolutely amazing. So just to give you an idea on how it works, it's almost where you click a button, you type in some information, as in what is your Azure subscription, you know, where's your database located, and, you know, basically what some additional information in there. You click a button and it automatically spins up the right virtual environment. It upgrades from, let's say you're in 2011, it upgrades to 2013. It allows you to have a look at it. You click another button, it upgrades it to 2015 and then 2016 and then Dynamics 365. And then finally, the last button is a button that Microsoft has to push, but then once they do it, then it goes online and you're done. It's absolutely fascinating how well Microsoft has sort of refined that tool over the years. So if anybody is looking for such an upgrade from on-premise to online, do reach out to your Microsoft partners or to Microsoft themselves, and they'll get you in touch with, you know, the best way of doing it. It's a must do.
So, you know, when FastTrack first came out, of course, it was very focused on Office 365 and then transitioned over to also tackle Dynamics 365 or CRM on-premise environments and migrate those as well. I think even in the AX side of things, they offer the service there. A lot of partners were skeptical of, you know, why does Microsoft need to look into our customers' projects like this? I see a lot of that skepticism is gone. Do you agree that that's the case now? And what's the relationship between Microsoft and partners when it comes to FastTrack?
Yeah, personally, I'm not skeptical. And as I'm actually being involved in a few FastTrack projects, I find it quite enjoyable. Now, we have built a good relationship with Microsoft and with the FastTrack solution architects. We know them very well. They respect us and we respect them. We are all on the same page. And what I usually say is that basically through the FastTrack program, you're getting a free sort of second pair of eyes from Microsoft, where they would look at the implementation and suggest recommendations on how you can actually do better. And usually if it's for the greater good of the project and for, you know, a successful go live. So some of it is just, you know, just ticking boxes, making sure that you have looked at everything and you haven't missed anything. And some of it is on a case by basis specifically, where they might say, actually, you know, looking at what we've got so far, what we're doing is maybe not considered best practice. However, we've discussed it with the customer. The customer wants to go down this route because of X, Y, and Z. We've communicated that with the FastTrack team. They understand why we're in that position, and then they agree with it. At least it's written in the sort of decision logs that's why we've taken those decisions. So I think, like, I always see added value from my perspective. The customers also see like a review, a governance process on the project. And again, it's not a matter of actually pointing fingers or making people look bad. I haven't seen that myself. It's usually we're always on the same page. We always talk about why we've done something in a specific way and why it has moved on, or why we've selected that route and so on. On top of that, being close to sort of someone from Microsoft and on the FastTrack program, you do get some extra information about, you know, early access, previews, you know, a view of what's on the roadmap, what's in the pipeline. Now, as MVPs, we do have access to that, but most of the time it's under NDA, and we cannot willy-nilly go and tell the customer, oh, this is coming, and then give them a date, and then, you know, that date would not be reached, and then that would be a sort of a breach of the NDA. Whereas if it's coming from Microsoft, then they can have a look at those programs programs, they can contact the product managers, and then they can say, hey, can they access an early preview, or can they be part of that program? And then that will help them sort of get a better result. And I find that really useful when you know a feature is coming out. The only way of implementing it right now is by doing customization. Whereas if you say, actually, let's wait for a couple of months, and that's going to be out of the box in the future, and it will require no customization to be implemented, you know, that again adds value. So there are different angles at which the Fast Track program would add value to a customer.
Yeah, very good. So with Fast Track, you know, back in the day, we used to use a thing called Dynamics SureStep, which was a methodology, a framework to do projects, whether they were, you know, upgrades at that point or new deployments. And my understanding is a lot of the Fast Track methodology is still that SureStep centric. Has that been your view, or have I got that wrong?
It has moved on a little bit. So I remember when we did the Fast Track training, there was some references to SureStep. The new methodology is called Success by Design, and it's loosely, very loosely based on SureStep. But, you know, most of the time, what Microsoft is trying to do is to see what is your organization's methodology and what is their methodology and how we can line up those two together. So they're not going to be imposing a specific methodology, especially that when I first saw the success by design sort of just diagram, if you want, or the different steps that you have to follow, I thought that looks a bit waterfall-y, where you've got an initial design, you've got a, you know, the implementation phase, you do some reviews in there, and then you do a delivery. Whereas nowadays, a lot of our customers are using an agile methodology where they might have an MVP that they deliver, and then iterations where they do, you know, just-in-time design and so on. So it has moved on, and Microsoft is not imposing anything. They're just saying, this is a framework. Those are the key things that we have to do. And usually it's reviews and governance and so on, which you would expect in a normal project. And we can sort of fit it in with whatever methodology you guys are using, which I thought was actually quite good.
Yeah. And the thing is, if it's a Fast Track migration, right, it's pretty prescriptive. You don't need to have an agile discussion around it pretty much if it's just a direct upgrade from you had to the latest version underground, you know, underlying software. You shouldn't be doing any changes in that transition, because that should be taken as a separate work stream right at a later date rather than an in-flight migration.
Exactly.
When you look at the premiumness of a brand, if you like Fast Track, in the last 2 years, you know, 2 years ago, James Phillips first announced a range of recognized Fast Track architects. And then at the virtual BizApp Summit this year, a whole range of new Dynamics 365 Fast Track architects were identified, as well as Power Platform architects.
That's correct, yeah.
Or PowerApps, can't remember what moniker they used there. Do you see that as more of a premium acknowledgement of skill than certification, like the standard, you know, certification exams?
Yeah, so I'm actually in the process of nominating some people from our organization to be recognized as Fast Track Solution Architects. This is more a recognition of the skills. So the criteria is quite clear. You need to have worked on two Fast Track programs in the past, at least two. And as such, if you have been involved with Fast Track programs in the past, you will be known to the people that actually do the Fast Track program. You would have exposure to the way it works. They will know who you are. They will not assess you because they're not allowed, because they know you so well. But another Fast Track solution architect from a different region, or, you know, from the program, will be doing the assessment. So first of all, they will know about your work. They'll know your capabilities. And then the next step is probably some prerequisites in terms of, you know, sort of what have you done in terms of qualifications and so on. But then there is the interview process. And the interview process is actually quite a neat one, where, you know, they will give you some scenarios to see to what extent you understand the platform, and are you going to give the customers the right outcome or the right solution. And Excellent. Part of the Fast Track training that we did, we looked at some perfectly sound design patterns, but then when you introduce an NFR, a non-functional requirement, you realize, actually, that's not going to scale, or that's not going to work, or this is an overkill, or this is going to be too expensive. So, and this is what they assess you on. So they give you a scenario and they give you non-functional requirements, and they say, do you think this is the best way of actually approaching it, or do you have a better way of actually implementing it? And that shows your understanding of the platform, of the different components and of the implications of taking one decision or the other. And I think that that truly shows that, you know, whenever they're going to assess you, they're going to have a look at your technical skills, of your understanding of the platform, and so on. So it is technical based rather than, you know, anything else.
Yeah, really good, really good. You know, in reflection, and I look at the journey in New Zealand to the cloud, and I remember Chris Auld, you know, who used to, is a director at Intergen, now works for Microsoft out of Singapore. And I remember him saying at a presentation when people were going, listen, I think my data is safer if it's in my server room that, you know, than in the cloud. And he was, I remember him talking, you know, and it was always, I keep seeing that yellow of their brand in my mind. You know, it's easier to, for someone to drive a, you know, a Holden car through the wall and nick your server and or data than you could ever get into a Microsoft data center. And, you know, this was part of that journey of building trust in the cloud. And of course, for us, then we had the Christchurch earthquake where a lot of people died and a lot of businesses that had all their data sitting in their offices was totally decimated with all the buildings that collapsed. And of course, 9/11, there was the, you know, once again, businesses that had data all in the building made it very difficult for them for, you know, continuity. And so there's, through, you know, my career, there have been these big events that kind of made massive shifts. And then Satya recently said that in the last 2 months, we've had the equivalent to 2 years of digital transformation around the world in businesses, right? Needing to rapidly deploy, you know, have staff not work from the office, but can work anywhere. And then, you know, I just even think of my lawyer, for example, the law firm, all their data, you know, they love photocopiers, right? They love taking copies of everything and getting physical signatures. And of course, all of a sudden, nobody's allowed to work from the office. And so, you know, my most recent contract with them was sent for electronic signing, something that I'd asked them for years, been traveling, right, that I needed to electronically sign because I was traveling. And no, we can't do it. We can't do it. We can't do it. You have to get power of attorney set up. And now all of a sudden overnight, they could do it, you know, because to survive, you have to kind of do it. And we're going through that now. What are you seeing in New Zealand with the current, you know, state of COVID-19 and the appetite of the businesses or the talk you've heard around the networks, et cetera, over the last couple of months? What are you seeing businesses' reaction to the need to make a lot more of their business processes cloud-enabled and a lot less dependency on physical location?
Yeah, I was actually having that same conversation today with the DXC regional manager, and we agreed that the life post-COVID is definitely going to look different. So first of all, sort of brick and mortar is dying from, you know, especially in IT and the IT industry, where now that they've realized that everybody can actually work from home and possibly be more effective than coming into the office and wasting time on commutes and, you know, all the water cooler conversations, which do have their advantages. But in terms of productivity has increased, you know, with people working from home during that COVID period. So yeah, there's definitely people seeing that there's lots of benefit in that space. And that means that the projects that we're going to get post-COVID are also going to be different in nature, as in they will enable people to work from home, they'll enable better collaboration, and they'll support people in that journey. There's definitely a change that we're seeing in here. A lot of businesses are going to restructure to actually provide that capability. So yeah, and you know, if you look at Inspire, right, earlier this week, most of the announcements were about, hey, did you know that the vendor can actually remotely or take over the management of Teams, for example? Did you know that now there is a HashiCorp consulting services that is available in Azure Market Space? So all of those are around along the lines of, actually, you know, you can outsource that. You don't worry about it. You can put it in the cloud and, you know, this, someone else can look for it and you guys can focus on delivering business or delivering value in your organization. So there's definitely a shift in the way people are thinking and the overall messaging. And what we're doing at DXC is understanding what that change is going to look like. What do we need to do to adapt? And that's something that I made really clear when I was talking to our regional manager. I'm like, you know, let's say I'm doing pre-sales. I'm a technical guy. I'm a delivery guy. So when we go and do a presentation, we always use innovation. We always use the latest, the greatest. We are always on top of it, right? So from a selling perspective, I want to see the same thing. Are you guys thinking long-term? It's not a traditional sales process. It's not a traditional project delivery methodology anymore. It's going to evolve. It's going to be innovative based on the current situation. So as I'm putting my heart and soul into making sure that my presentation is the best possible with the latest innovations, I want to see the same thing done from a salesperson, the same thing done from a project manager who's actually talking about the delivery capability and so on. All of that is changing given the current circumstances. I mean, there are industries that are dying around the world because of the COVID. The luxury industry is now dying. You know, the face-to-face, brick and mortar, again, are suffering. So there will be a big transformation, and we're just at the tip of it. We just need to understand what it is so that we can adapt to it.
Let's talk a bit about your journey as a solution architect, and particularly, you know, Power Platform architecture. And, you know, you've had a lot of people work for you in the various teams over time. And, you know, typically in my experience, I would have seen somebody become a solution architect from one or two paths. Either they would have spent, you know, quite a few years as a functional business analyst or a functional consultant that would have transitioned through to becoming a solution architect. Or I would have seen somebody with a strong .NET development type background, developer, and they would, you know, a natural career progression would be that into solution architect. And that's, you know, my very simplistic look at it and how I used to run my teams. What are you seeing from a career path? What do you see as people that are wanting to aspire to be a solution architect? What are typical kind of timelines, expectations that you would have, you know, and I'm talking about not just skills, but even experience? You know, there's something that can be said for, you know, somebody that's done, you know, 10 different or 20 different, you know, implementations as somebody that's done one that's been successful and think, right, they're ready for prime time now as an architect. What are the kind of things you're looking for?
Yeah, so, you know, the solution architects have one common answer in their sort of repository of answers, and it's it depends, right? And that it depends shows actually experience, right? So if you've only worked on a couple of projects, even though they've been successful, someone will give you a problem and you say, oh, that's how we're going to do it based on your experience on those projects. And that's not necessarily the right answer. Whereas someone that has more experience and have sort of learned, you know, the easy way or the hard way, what are the better ways of designing a solution, then they will always say, oh, well, actually, you're missing some information in here. You know, who's going to use it? Where are you going to use it? You know, give me more non-functional requirements so that I can actually design a better solution for you. So there's definitely a you know, the experience that will play an important role in designing a good solution. I myself have a developer background. I've been a developer, you know, not professionally necessarily since I was a teenager. I loved it. I knew, you know, even before reaching university that this is what I wanted to do when as a professional. I specialized in it. I did my master's in it. And then I, you know, got a job in it. And then I carried on. The journey is quite a long one. And, you know, there is a lot of sort of appetite to get there. So if, you know, recently someone said, oh, well, you know, DXC is going through a restructure. Do you want to be the CTO? And I'm like, do I want it? Do I want to be the CTO or do I have a different career path? So first of all, you need to really want to be a solution architect. You need to understand what it implies to be a solution architect, especially from someone who's coming from a different background, whether it's functional or technical, being, let's say, a very good tech lead. As they say, like if you're a technical person, you're usually a very good developer or very good tech lead, and then you take the leap into becoming a really bad solution architect, and then you learn, and then you become a very good solution architect, and then you take the leap to become an enterprise architect, and usually you're a very, very bad one, and then you learn on how to become a better enterprise architect. And it's simply because we would be so attached to what we've been doing in the past, and we know how to do it very well, that we don't actually, you know, focus on, actually, this is a completely different beast or a completely different way of doing things. So it's a bit of a mentality shift. From my perspective, you know, if someone is ambitious, they know what the role is, they've got good mentorship and good guidance around them, I think that helped me a lot. And this is where, you know, not only your expertise or your, you know, experience comes in, but also a little bit of luck, a little bit of, you know, the people you're surrounded with, the support that you're going to get will help you go a long way to really fit into the solution or the role that you want. And I think key to all of that is just keep on top of it, understand what's new, the different ways of doing it, and what are the implications.
So you mentioned there, you know, the track from solution architect to enterprise architect. Do you think that in the biz app space that there is scope for enterprise architecture over solution architecture? And I suppose before we go down that path, how do you classify enterprise architecture over solution architecture?
Yeah, so this is the terminology is very important in here. So I'm TOGAF certified. So TOGAF is the open architecture framework, the open group architecture framework. And it's about, you know, enterprise architecture, one of them. There's Zuckman as well. So there's a couple available out there. And
but TOGAF seems to be the one that I've definitely most come across in my career.
Yes, yeah, exactly. And you realize that actually TOGAF is, or just enterprise architecture as they define it, is less about technology and more about business. So as an enterprise, what are your business goals? What are your business needs? What are the applications that you need, as in what do you want them to do? And then one part of that is how do you fulfill those application needs with technology? And this is the bit where you rely on solution architects that are specialized in specific areas. So for example, the Power Platform or Dynamics or, you know, Microsoft 365, or even, you know, completely different landscape, not necessarily .NET or Microsoft backgrounds. So the enterprise architecture is more aligning sort of the technology with the business goals, the business drivers, and the direction that the organization is taking. And again, technology is a very small part of it. So there's a big leap in there. An enterprise architect cannot be a Power Platform enterprise architect. That, in my opinion, would be a senior solution architect who knows
Correct.
About the Power Platform and more, but is specialized in the Power Platform. So yeah, that's my view at least. So to me, like, you would be a very good solution architect. When it goes, so sometimes people use the term enterprise architect is when you know a bit more beyond the platform that you're specialized in. And I think this is purely being a senior solution architect who knows the technology very well, but is specialized in one location. In the past, I used to say every Dynamics developer used to be a .NET developer by heart, whereas now I say every Dynamics developer is an Azure developer by heart, because it's such an integrated part of the whole ecosystem that you need to know about it. Same thing applies to the solution architects, at least from a technical perspective, is that you need to know, how am I going to build my solution with all the different moving components that go beyond what we used to know as Dynamics and into the ecosystem of Microsoft, of, you know, the M365, of Azure, and so on. I typically do a session on, you know, in the conferences, I do a session on security. And, you know, back in the day, security was basically you've got an AD account and you've got the authorization that is done through Dynamics. Whereas now with Azure, with Microsoft 365, with Dynamics, you've got layers. It's almost like an onion. Like, you can have a general protection layer that is available for your entire platform. And then you go a level down and then you've got, you know, maybe groups and AD groups that are sort of governed by Microsoft 365. And what does that imply in terms of other access or maybe DLP, so data protection and so on. And then you go down to the Dynamics 365. So the whole ecosystem has changed. And, you know, if you're talking about enterprise solution architect, if you want in the Power Platform Dynamics space, is just understanding all of those and having a good grasp of it.
But doesn't an enterprise architect have to be much broader than, as you say, just the Power Platform? You know, for me, I would also have an expectation that you knew a lot about AWS, that you knew a lot about, you know, Google Cloud Platform, that you, you know, had a good understanding of the smorgasbord of technologies available to use if you're going to come up with some really, you know, unbiased solutions.
Absolutely.
And therefore, you definitely can't just say, hey, you know, I'm an enterprise architect of the Power Platform or Dynamics 365 for that matter, where at a minimum, you need to have a thorough understanding of Azure and, you know, M365, as you say, but also outside the Microsoft ecosystem. Do you think that really should be playing into that enterprise architecture field as well?
Yeah, absolutely. So at the end of the day, you need to make the right decision for your enterprise. And in order to do that, you need to have enough information to make that decision. And most of the time, especially in the TOGAF training, they taught us to actually rely on people that are specialized in that area to understand what are the implications of going, you know, the Microsoft route, the Azure route, the AWS route, or, you know, Salesforce or Dynamics or whatever it is, and then be able to have a good understanding of what the implications are and then come up with the final decision. So yeah, absolutely. But, you know, for someone to be knowledgeable at depth in all of those technologies is, you know, a unicorn, basically. So you need to be surrounded by people that can give you good advice and be able to make a call based on that.
Yeah. So an enterprise architect, I definitely see, would involve specialists, right? Somebody with deep core knowledge in a functional area.
That's correct.
Or a tech area that would be brought in and to, you know, solution out that particular area. Tell me about, what skills do you look for in a solution architect that are not technical?
That are not technical. So
yeah, and an aspiring solution architect, you know, somebody that's come to you in Rome and said, Rami, I want to become a solution architect. You know, as I say, they might be from a functional or a .NET type background, or, you know, somebody that's worked for a good long time on the Power Platform or / Dynamics 365. What are you looking for outside of technical skills with these individuals?
I think one of the main things is the listening skills, because your customers are always going to come and, you know, talk about their problems, and you need to be a good listener to understand exactly what is the problem that is at hand, to really go through the details and not miss anything, especially when it comes to non-functional requirements. I think NFRs are sort of a recurring theme in our discussion. And that's because, you know, as a solution architect, this is what you do. This is what you breathe and you drink every day. Like, NFRs are something that you have to watch out for. So they need to really be good listeners to understand what is the problem at hand. The other thing is to sort of have the open-mindedness of actually swaying one way or the other based on the current requirements. So you don't want a solution architect that, you know, basically uses a sledgehammer for every nail that comes their way. They need to adapt. They need to be flexible and agile and sort of come up with really a truly solution that is the best solution for the customer given the current circumstances. So I think those are the main two things: is a good listener and, you know, be able to make the right call based on the information that they are getting. And then obviously the technical bit is what sort of completes it.
Yeah. So what about skills around handling politics on a project, right? I've never ever seen an enterprise-based project where politics wasn't in play. And I'm talking about, you know, going into customers' site and seeing people that have agendas. I've seen, you know, executives within an organization have total counter ambitions for a project. You know, I've seen CIOs and CEOs have vicious disagreements in project meetings within an organization with almost absolutely conflicting desires for the outcome. And of course, you know, it can affect their careers. You know, the success or failure of a project can mean either they're going up to a new level or they're going, you know, they're going to get, you know, sidelined. Or particularly, I've noticed this a lot in public sector. And, you know, my experience in public sector is I've had some projects in New Zealand before I left in PubSec, but I had quite a few in Australia. And, you know, I found that there's a lot of folks in pub sector that are, you know, a servants of the crown, so to speak, that they're not necessarily, and I know I could get, you know, killed for this saying, they're not necessarily the higher skilled technologists, but they can be very agenda or politically driven. How do you encourage your teams to understand and navigate that type of environment? Because at the end of the day, it's very easy for a customer to turn around and say, hey, it's your fault, you know, because they always will scapegoat outside the organization, as in, you know, what I've seen. How do you train your staff on handling those, you know, to be able to spot early that there's an agenda in play, and that if it isn't acknowledged and in some ways addressed with the right level of competency inside your organization, could derail your projects?
Yeah, that's a very good point, Mark. So, you know, politics is always something that you have to keep an eye on. And it sort of comes, like, probably maybe the reason why I didn't mention it is because it happens on a day-to-day basis where you're almost automatically tuned to sort of know how to handle it and to work with it. So there's two folds to it. You will have sometimes a bit of resistance from customers where, as you said, they've got an agenda. This is how you're going to do it. And the worst is when you don't have a good relationship with a customer or with an individual to be able to actually influence them on going one way or the other. In that case, this is where, you know, things like fast track would come in, the governance processes would come in, and you as a consultant or as an architect, your job is to advise them on what's the best way of doing it. You know, this is the best way, this is what we're going to document. And then if they disagree with you, then you say, well, this is our advice. It's your call at the end of the day. You are the customer. We will do whatever you want. But, you know, put it on the record that this is what we've suggested to begin with. And if anything goes wrong, which is X, Y, and Z, we anticipate will go wrong, then at least we've done our job to let you know what the outcome is. And this is where decision registers would come in. You know, fast track is basically based on recommendations and decision registers and communication with the customer. Communication is key. But then, you know, with experience, especially when you start, you know, getting a bit of gray hair and, you know, you've got a name for yourself in the market and so on, then you will notice that the customers are inclined to actually listen to your recommendations. And again, it's about, you know, not necessarily headbutting, because obviously that's not going to work, but in order to talk to them in the right way, to influence them in the right way, to, you know, get to know them a little bit. Sometimes it's you know, a little bit beyond the sort of the hard skills. It's more on the soft skills about how do you address them? How do you talk to them? How do you give them confidence? How do you gain their trust and so on? So it's a little bit of, you know, working with the customer, soft skills, negotiation skills that you can sort of work on. And, you know, most of the time, at the end of the day, they want what's best for their organization. And if they trust you that you're making the right call, then they will listen to you and then they will look at how you're doing. And, you know, public sector is a typical example where all of that happens. Big financial mm-hmm. institutions is another one, you know, especially from a security perspective with everything is a no-no and so on. So, yeah, it's just, you know, a soft skill that you have to learn and how to navigate the politics, who's influential, who's the decision maker, understand the hierarchies, go and talk to the right people if you've got access to them. Otherwise, you know, just influence, talk to the influencers and then let them actually transmit that message.
What's the common skill gap you've seen in aspiring architects that you've needed to guide on, you know, skill development or training that needs to be undertaken?
So typically in solution architects is that jump and understanding what the role is. A lot of them will be, as I said, sort of attached to how they did things in the past, and they will carry on doing it as is. The second part is sort of to understand what sort of documentation that you need in order to make sure that you've got everything in line and everything is clear to the customer on what you're trying to deliver, and also to understand the structure. So typically, or at least the organizations that I worked with, was most of the time fortunate enough to work with sort of counterpart architects from the customer perspective, and they would usually have a hierarchy of those where you would have almost like an enterprise architect that looks after all of them, and then you would have the specialist from a data perspective or from platform perspective or from a product perspective. You get to know them, get to understand what, so a little bit of politics about sort of understanding the influencers and the decision makers and navigate through that in order to, you know, get basically the best outcome for the customer. So once you understand how it all works, like the machine of solution architecture, the politics behind it, the processes and so on, then, you know, I don't want to say it, but it does become easier, almost like a cookie cutter where you're like, okay, well, this is what we're dealing with. This is the situation that we've got. This is how we need to approach it. And then you get the outcome at the end.
Yeah, really good. Type of timeframes. And I don't know, this is not exact science. I'm not holding you to a number, but like, are you looking for X number of years experience on, you know, project delivery before someone makes that transition from the roles that they're in to that first solution architecture gig that you might put them on? What do you see as that path?
I look more for ambition and appetite to actually be into that position, and readiness is part of it. So, you know, even the transition from being like a grad to a senior developer, let's say, I've seen some junior or intermediate developers that are way more advanced than seniors. with way less experience, mainly because they're energetic, they love it, you know, they work their asses off to actually get where they want to be. They do a lot of research, they spend a lot of their personal time upskilling and so on to get to the position that they are in. From a solution architecture perspective, if you want to put a number of years in question, typically that, you know,
maybe the number of projects rather than number of, like, you know, like, they've been in the trenches, so to speak, so they've got that experience and awareness outside the technology.
You don't want someone who's done like 100 small projects. That's probably not going to be beneficial, but a combination of different size projects, maybe a dozen projects is a good start to actually get that sort of overall experience on different sizes, different capabilities, different landscapes, and so on. And again, like, you know, when you become a solution architect, you're usually, one that is just emerging, that is getting a lot of support from mentors and from other people helping. So you will get the guidance that you need, and then they'll guide you through it. Typically, I wouldn't trust someone who's just done like a year of work and worked maybe on, you know, 2-3 projects and say, okay, I'm a solution architect. Although every single, you know, sort of solution architect that, well, no, maybe not every single, but a lot of the people that I interview that would have solution architect as the title, and then you, the moment you scratch the surface, like first 5 minutes of the interview, you would not know exactly where they are, and they're usually developers trying to glorify themselves. So yeah, it takes a little bit of time.
Rami, there's so many other questions, you know, and other topics that we wanted to drill into today, but we've run short on time. So we might have to do another podcast and discuss things like DevOps and community initiatives and that type of thing in the country. But why don't we just wrap up with some quick fire questions and then talk about where people can connect with you online and whatnot and what you're doing in the community. So first of all, if you could be famous, what would you be famous for?
My looks.
I love it. What's the last product you returned?
The last product that I returned. Man, I'm not ready for those questions.
See, this is the thing. This shows how Kiwi-ified you become, right? Because as Kiwis, we generally would just go, you know what? I'll live with it. Like, you don't return stuff, right?
Yeah, yeah. I think it was a watch, a smartwatch that I sort of purchased. It wasn't, you know, what I wanted, and I returned it. Yeah.
What's the worst haircut you've ever had?
My current haircut.
The COVID cut.
The post-COVID cut, yes.
Yeah. What is one family tradition you're going to carry on in the future within your family?
Oh, dinner time.
Nice. Like dinner together?
Yeah. Tea time. So to us, it's so sacred. Like, you know, when we're having dinner, no digital devices, no TV. Everybody's around the table. Everybody's sharing the stories about the story, their day. You know, it brings us together, basically. So it's very important.
Yeah. I like it. What do you believe in spite of having no proof of it?
A strong pipeline in the future, post-COVID.
I love it. Good answer. Would you rather not have arms or legs, and why?
Legs. Yeah, I think my arms are what I use for sort of writing and, you know, developing and, you know, yeah. So legs. I always thought, look, what would life be like without legs? I think I can live without that.
Yeah, so true. Well, Rami, it's been good having you on the show. You're an accomplished author and, of course, great community contributor. If people want to connect with you online, maybe they've got more questions that they want to ask you, you know, after today's podcast, where's the best place for them to find you?
So probably LinkedIn, Rami Mundla, just look me up. I'm sure I'm the only one. And Twitter is the alternative, Rami Mundla as well.
Hey, thanks again for joining me today on the Power Platform Show. Full show notes for this episode can be found at nz365guy.com/234. I'm your host, Business Application MVP Mark Smith, otherwise known as the NZ365 Guy. If you'd like to see me interview or have me interview a guest that you know have got special skills that you think would be relevant, particularly skills and experience that you would think that other people in the community would benefit from, I'd love to hear who you recommend or you know, jointly reach out with them, get in touch with me. Best place to get me is message me on LinkedIn, NZ365 Guy. If you look me up there, you'll find me. Otherwise, bye for now.